Therefore I beseech you to give the steward some account of your state, so that if you do not fare as badly as we fear, we can calm our anxious spirits. And truly I never resent living cloistered as a nun, except when I hear that you are sick, because then I would like to be free to come to visit and care for you with all the diligence I could muster. But even though I cannot, I thank the Lord God for everything, knowing full well that not a leaf turns without His willing it so. Pope Urban VIII suddenly took sick, too. He contracted the fever that ran epidemic through Rome that summer of 1623 and was compelled to postpone his coronation until late September. Even without the official ceremony, Urban had commenced the exercise of his new powers immediately upon accepting the vote of the conclave, as was his right. On the very day of his election, August 6th, he issued the bulls of canonization that made saints of Ignatius Loyola and Francis Xavier, the Jesuit founders, and also Philip Neri, the Apostle of Rome. Within weeks, Urban VIII began appointing his brothers and nephews to potent positions in his new regime, inviting detractors to quip that the three bees on the family escutcheon had led former lives as horseflies. The opportunistic Barberini, after all, laid no prior claim to nobility or wealth. Nevertheless, the Barberini Pope now commanded the respect of all Christian princes and princes of the Church. Urban turned his married brother Carlo into commander-in-chief of the papal armies, and made a cardinal of Carlo's erudite eldest son, Francesco. This new cardinal nephew was the same Francesco Barberini who had just earned his doctorate at Pisa, having been a favored student of Benedetto Castelli and, through him, of Galileo as well. No sooner had the 26-year-old graduate become His Eminence and chief lieutenant to His Holiness than he also found himself elected a member in good standing of the Lynxian Academy. On September 29th, the day of Urban's coronation, the new pope is said to have displayed the dramatic devotional style that characterized his memorable 20-year tenure. As he prepared to receive the white papal robes and the velvet shoes of the fisherman, he threw himself before the altar in the Chapel of Tears. Prostrate, he prayed for death to take him the moment his pontificate veered from the good of the Church. If such a thing should ever happen, God forbid. Then Urban consented to be carried in the silk-upholstered sedia gestatoria, the capacious portable throne flanked by ostrich feather fans, into St. Peter's Basilica, where the Sacred College of Cardinals installed him according to the ancient ceremony. Receive this tiara adorned with three crowns. Know that thou art the father of princes and kings, victor of the whole world under the earth, the vicar of our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory and honor without end. Compared to the elderly Paul and the sickly Gregory of recent memory, the 55-year-old Urban cut a youthful, almost military figure, especially when seen riding on horseback through the Vatican gardens. If the Pope resembled a general, he showed he could strategize like one, too. Indeed, history provoked him to use this talent repeatedly over the next two decades in the waging of wars for the defense of the Italian peninsula and the integrity of the Papal States. Urban would also battle the Protestant Reformation, which still continued to erode the power of the Roman Church, by stepping up Catholic reform measures in his own style. He foresaw improved ecclesiastical education and networks of foreign missions radiating from a Roman base. "This is a city upon a hill," Urban pronounced in announcing a thorough investigation of Rome's own religious health, "which is exposed for the whole world to gaze upon." Urban intended also to gild and glorify the physical beauty of the Holy See with new building projects and monuments. Their construction would employ armies of architects, sculptors, and painters, and invent Urban's reputation as a great patron of the arts. Upon hearing that a group of admirers had expressed the wish to commission a monument in the Pope's honor during his lifetime, instead of after his death as was customary, Urban affirmed, "Let them. I am not an ordinary pope. either. As bookish as he was bold, Urban peopled his curia with literati. He chose for his master of pontifical ceremonies Monsignor Virginio Cesarini, Lynxian, who wrote acclaimed poetry and had pursued the study of mathematics after hearing an inspirational lecture by Galileo. It was from Cesarini that Galileo had received observations of the 1618 comets, and to Cesarini that Galileo addressed his ultimate reply to the Jesuit father Grassi in the Assayer. Immediately upon this book's long-awaited publication in Rome in late October 1623, Cesarini began reading it aloud to Urban at mealtimes. Urban, who had studied under the Jesuits at the Collegio Romano, could not help admiring the style with which Galileo skewered Grassi via Sarsi on his similes. "I believe that good philosophers fly alone like eagles," Galileo said in the Assayer, "and not in flocks like starlings. It is true that because eagles are rare birds, they are little seen and less heard, while birds that fly like starlings fill the sky with shrieks and cries, and wherever they settle, befoul the earth beneath them." Charmed, Urban declared himself all eagerness for Galileo to come to see him. But the great Florentine philosopher remained ill through the autumn, and in the winter the harsh weather restrained him. While Urban awaited Galileo's arrival, he continued to have Galileo's words read aloud at table. "The crowd of fools who know nothing, Sarsi, is infinite. Those who know very little of philosophy are numerous. Few indeed are they who really know some part of it, and only one knows all." Pope Urban found his favorite passage from the Assayer in Galileo's parable about the song of the cicada, which demonstrated the boundless creativity of God in the bounty of nature. "Once upon a time, in a very lonely place, there lived a man endowed by nature with extraordinary curiosity and a very penetrating mind," the story began. "For a pastime he raised birds, whose songs he much enjoyed, and he observed with great admiration the happy contrivance by which they could transform at will the very air they breathed into a variety of sweet songs. One night this man chanced to hear a delicate song close to his house, and being unable to connect it with anything but some small bird, he set out to capture it. When he arrived at a road, he found a shepherd boy who was blowing into a kind of hollow stick while moving his fingers about on the wood, thus drawing from it a variety of notes similar to those of a bird, though by quite a different method. Puzzled, but impelled by his natural curiosity, he gave the boy a calf in exchange for this flute and returned to solitude. But realizing that if he had not chanced to meet the boy, he would never have learned of the existence of a new method of forming musical notes and the sweetest songs, he decided to travel to distant places in the hope of meeting with some new adventure. As the man roved, he encountered songs made by a bow sawing upon some fibers stretched over a hollowed piece of wood, by the hinges of a temple gate, by a man rubbing his fingertip around the rim of a goblet, and by the beating wings of wasps. And as his wonder grew, his conviction proportionately diminished that he knew how sounds were produced. Nor would all his previous experiences have sufficed to teach him or even allow him to believe that crickets derive their sweet and sonorous shrilling by scraping their wings together, particularly as they cannot fly at all. Well, after this man had come to believe that no more ways of forming tones could possibly exist, he suddenly found himself once more plunged deeper into ignorance and bafflement than ever. For having captured in his hands a cicada, he failed to diminish its strident noise either by closing its mouth or stopping its wings. Yet he could not see it move the scales that covered its body or any other thing. At last he lifted up the armor of its chest, and there he saw some thin, hard ligaments beneath. Thinking the sound might come from their vibration, he decided to break them in order to silence it. But nothing happened until his needle drove too deep, and transfixing the creature, he took away its life with its voice, so that he was still unable to determine whether the song had originated in those ligaments. And by this experience, his knowledge was reduced to diffidence, so that when asked how sounds were created, he used to answer tolerantly that although he knew a few ways, he was sure that many more existed which were not only unknown, but unimaginable. This section of the Assayer delighted Urban with its graceful language and poetic conceit, and even more because it expressed his own philosophy of science, to wit, as earnestly as men may seek to understand the workings of the universe, they must remember that God is not hampered by their limited logic, that all observed effects may have been wrought by him in any one of an infinite number of omnipotent ways, and these must ever evade mortal comprehension. Chapter 10. To Busy Myself in Your Service. Galileo's summertime illness of 1623 is the first of his infirmities to be documented in the surviving letters from his daughter. Although these offer no good clue, unfortunately, to the specific nature of Galileo's disorder, they demonstrate clearly Suor Maria Celeste's familiarity with his indifferent health and how it preoccupied her. She hung on word of him, which arrived now from the steward, now from her uncle Benedetto Landucci. The first week of Galileo's stay in Florence, she prepared him a treat of marzipan shaped like little fish. And the second week, hearing he could hardly eat a bite of anything, she found four fresh plums to tempt his appetite. After he returned to Bellosguardo in September, she willingly helped him with his correspondence. Galileo's affliction compromised his handwriting, so that his extant papers include many documents penned in a small, cramped hand, with the lines on a steep slant up or down the page, as though their author were working lying down. Galileo's followers used his changeable penmanship as a clue to help establish chronological order among the welter of his undated papers, relying also on ink color, for he purchased different types in different cities, and any special characteristics of paper, such as the distinguishing rhinoceros watermark from the end of his Paduan period. Although Suor Maria Celeste often sacrificed neatness for speed in her own writing, she readily lent her stylish script to Galileo, as well as to the Mother Abbess, for whom she did not merely copy letters from drafts, but composed them from scratch. To begin, she enlarged the first letter of the first paragraph's first word, as in an illuminated manuscript, and festooned the capital with loops and tails, turning her pen to vary the width of her strokes from a hair's breadth to a broad ribbon. As her sentences flowed along to the right, she bent all the lowercase d's back over themselves in the opposite direction, hiding each small d circle beneath a huge canopy that might shade an entire word. Where the tip of a tall, right-tilting letter met the top of a left-slanting d, she joined them in a pointed arch. Occasionally, she decorated the heads of pages and the ends of paragraphs with flourishes, inserted extra ripples of squiggles into salutations and sign-offs, and on her envelopes she drew, more than wrote, the neighborhood, Bellosguardo, or city name, Rome, Florence, Siena, that sufficed for an address. "Here is the copied letter, sire," Suor Maria Celeste complied with Galileo's request on September 30th, "along with the wish that it meet with your approval so that at other times I may again be able to help you by my work, seeing as it gives me such great pleasure and happiness to busy myself in your service." She soon found another way to assist him by sewing a set of table linens her father could use on his trip to Rome for carrying food or spreading over tables at inns along the way, even though the press of her convent duties left her little, if any, free time. In addition to praying the divine office, the liturgy of the hours, the major daily occupation of the cloistered nuns, the poor clares at San Mateo worked long hours to sustain their ever-struggling economy. They grew a few fruits and vegetables to feed themselves, did all their own cleaning and cooking, and also produced articles for outside sale, such as fine embroidered handkerchiefs, lace, herbal medicines, and bread in the summertime when it was too hot for anyone else to bake. The rough brown habits they wore, with black linen veil and knotted cord belt, never showed the dirt of their menial labors. Suor Maria Celeste, musically talented like most members of her family, also directed the choir from time to time, and taught the novices how to sing Gregorian chant. In her capacity as the convent's apothecary, she assisted the visiting doctor, fabricated remedies in pill or tonic form, and nursed the sick nuns in the infirmary, where Suor Arcangela often occupied a bed. Although Suor Maria Celeste, who spoke for both of them in her letters, never directly accused Suor Arcangela of malingering, she sometimes alluded to a hysterical component in her sister's complaints. The younger daughter's moodiness and taciturnity may have characterized her nature from childhood, or the traits may have developed in reaction to cloistered life, which had been her father's choice and not her own. The arduous existence of the poor clares was described baldly by a contemporary of Suor Maria Celeste's and Suor Arcangela's, Maria Domitila Galuzzi, who entered the house of the Clarisses in Pavia in 1616 and later wrote her own interpretation of the rule of St. Clare. "Show her how we dress in vile clothing," Maria Domitila counseled any nun introducing a candidate for admission to the sisters' way of life. "Always go barefoot, get up in the middle of the night, sleep on hard boards, fast continually, and eat crass, poor, and Lenten food, and spend the major part of the day reciting the divine office and in long mental prayers, and how all of our recreation, pleasure, and happiness is to serve, love, and give pleasure to the beloved Lord, attempting to imitate His holy virtues, to mortify and vilify ourselves, to suffer contempt, hunger, thirst, heat, cold, and other inconveniences for His love." Although the Council of Trent had specifically denounced the once common practice of forcing young women to take the veil, the percentage of patrician girls entering convents in Florence actually rose through the remainder of the 16th century and continued to increase on into the 17th. Whether or not Galileo's daughters walked willingly into San Mateo, Suor Maria Celeste found her place there. The same cannot be said with certainty of Suor Arcangela. If she ever wrote a letter to her father, it has not been preserved. On top of all her appointed tasks, Suor Maria Celeste voluntarily took up the sort of domestic work she would have performed for her father and brother had she lived in their home on Bellosguardo. Despite her distance, she insinuated herself between the two of them, always placating her father while pleading Vincenzo's point of view in matters large or small. "Vincenzo stands in dire want of new collars," she informed Galileo in an undated letter, "even though he may not think so, as it suits him to have his used ones bleached as the need arises. But we are struggling to accommodate him in this practice, since the collars are truly old, and therefore I would like to make him 4 new ones with lace trim and matching cuffs. However, since I have neither the time nor the money to do this all by myself, I should like for you to make up what I lack, sire, by sending me a braccio of fine cambric and at least 18 or 20 lire to buy the lace, which my lady Hortensa makes for me very beautifully. And because the collars worn nowadays tend to be large, they require a good deal of trimming for properly finishing them. Moreover, seeing as Vincenzo has been so obedient to you, sire, in always wearing his cuffs, I maintain, for that reason, he deserves to have handsome ones, and therefore do not be astonished that I ask for this much money." The wide white collars Suor Maria Celeste sewed, washed, and bleached for her father and brother frame Galileo's face in every formal portrait painted of him. At home alone, however, tending his experiments or his grapevines, the shirt-sleeved Galileo donned an old leather apron. "I am ashamed that you see me in this clown's habit," he reportedly said to a group of distinguished visitors who arrived one afternoon to find him in his garden, in his work clothes.
I'll go and dress myself as a philosopher."
But he must have been jesting, for when the men asked Galileo why he didn't hire someone to take over his manual labor, he replied,
"No, no, I should lose the pleasure. If I thought it as much fun to have things done as it is to do them, I'd be glad to."
This outdoor recreation tempered the concentration of Galileo's scholarly work and kept him close to nature. Though the time he spent in his kitchen garden, his orchard, and his vineyard restored his spirits, the hours took their toll on Galileo's well-worn work garment, which he periodically sent to Sor Maria Celeste for repair.
"Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, I am returning the rest of your shirts that we have sewn, and the leather apron, too, mended as best I could. I am also sending back your letters, which are so beautifully written that they have only kindled my desire to see more examples of them. Now I am tending to the work on the linens, so that I hope you will be able to send me the trim for borders at the ends, and I remind you, sire, that the trimmings needs to be wide, because the linens themselves are rather short. I have just placed Suor Arcangela once more into the doctor's hands to see, with God's help, if she can be relieved of her wearisome illness, which causes me no end of worry and work. Salvadore Galileo's servant tells me that you want to pay us a visit soon, sire, which is precisely what we so desire, though I must remind you that you are obliged to keep the promise you made us, that is, to spend an entire evening here, and to be able to have dinner in the convent parlor, because we deliver the excommunication to the tablecloth, and not the meals thereon. I enclose herewith a little composition which, aside from expressing to you the extent of our need, will also give you the excuse to have a hearty laugh at the expense of my foolish writing. But because I have seen how good-naturedly you always encourage my meager intelligence, sire, you have lent me the courage to attempt this essay. Indulge me then, Lord Father, and with your usual loving tenderness, please help us. I thank you for the fish, and send you loving greetings along with Suor Arcangela. May our Lord grant you complete happiness. From San Mateo, the 20th day of October, 1623, most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste."
Suor Maria Celeste's casual reference to excommunication poked private fun at a practice of the poor Clares. The rule of the order stated plainly that no visitors could enter the refectory where the nuns dined. The convent of San Mateo, however, maintained a separate parlor where a sister's family members might properly be received. They could bring their own food, too, and share it with her. Thus, the dishes themselves, whether cooked in the convent or carried in by the guests, could be eaten with impunity, so long as everyone ate in his or her proper place. A black iron gate, or grill, separated the parlor from the nuns' quarters, and all exchanges passed through the lattice of its bars. Another grill pierced the wall near the altar in the adjacent church of San Mateo, so that the voices of the nuns singing in their choir could reach the townspeople attending Mass on the other side. Although the poor Clares devoted their earthly lives to praying for all the souls of the world, they required the maintenance of a severed space for this work, where they lived hidden in God's embrace. These practices traced back to the early 13th century, when Francis of Assisi spurned splendid wealth to found his order of friars minor on the principles of poverty, obedience, and devotion. The rich, privileged young Chiara Offreduccio, or Clare, joined him as his first female follower in the spring of 1212. Francis cut off her golden hair and sent her begging in the streets of Assisi. In time, the two divided their labors so that Francis traveled widely, preaching the gospel, while Clare headed the contemplative Second Order of Franciscans, known as the Clarisses, or Poor Ladies, the Poor Clares. Clare sequestered herself for life in the convent Francis built her at San Damiano, where she slept on the floor and ate practically nothing. She also initiated the tradition of work in the convents, filling the hours between the daily offices with spinning and embroidery. "The sisters to whom the Lord has given the grace of working should labor faithfully and devotedly after the hour of terce at work which contributes to integrity and the common good,
in such a way that, while idleness, the enemy of the soul, is banished, they do not extinguish the spirit of holy prayer and dedication to which all other temporal things should be subservient.
The Rule of St. Clare, Chapter 7.
By the time Sœur Maria Celeste joined the order, the Rule of St. Clare had relaxed on some issues and tightened on others, as dictated by church policy and the individual interpretation of each convent's mother abbess. 17th-century parents, for example, paid dowries for their daughters to enter Clarisse convents in Italy, a requirement that might have horrified Francis and Clare. Poverty remained a central tenet of the rule, rendering all poor Clares dependent on alms. Sœur Maria Celeste, perforce, appealed frequently to her father for financial help, though she found this duty embarrassing. It was one thing to request money to buy presents for Vincenzo, and quite another to ask anything for herself. In the Little Composition, she apologetically enclosed with her letter of October 20th, she apparently meant to soften her current plea by making a comedy of the convent's neediness. Unfortunately, the attachment has disappeared, so it is impossible to say whether it took the form of an essay or perhaps a dramatic action of the sort Galileo used to write and liked to see performed through the grill when he visited San Mateo. The nuns also wrote plays in keeping with convent traditions, for the church authorities encouraged them to stage spiritual comedies and tragedies drawn from biblical themes as part of their education and recreation. Whatever Sœur Maria Celeste's request, Galileo never failed to fulfill it, precipitating a flood of appreciation in return. Sœur Maria Celeste's word for the loving indulgence that characterized her father's attentiveness, amore volezza, appears more than 20 times in her 124 surviving letters, thanking him for some recent act of thoughtfulness or generosity toward herself, her sister, or someone else in the convent. Thus, all the while that Galileo was inventing modern physics, teaching mathematics to princes, discovering new phenomena among the planets, publishing science books for the general public, and defending his bold theories against establishment enemies, he was also buying thread for Sœur Louisa, choosing organ music for Mother Aquileia, shipping gifts of food, and supplying his home-grown citrus fruits, wine, and rosemary leaves for the kitchen and apothecary at San Mateo.
If I wanted to attempt to thank you with words, sire, for these recent presents you sent us, she wrote on October 29th, 1623, the week after dispatching her little composition, I could not imagine how to begin to fully express our indebtedness. And what is more, I believe that such a display of gratitude would not even please you, for, as kind and good as you are, you would prefer true thankfulness of the spirit from us over any demonstration of speeches or ceremonies. We will therefore serve you better if we apply what we do best, and by that I mean prayer, in seeking to recognize and make recompense for this and all the other innumerable and even far greater gifts that we have received from you. Anxiously anticipating her father's imminent departure for Rome, she feared that the separation would be a long one, and she dreaded being deprived of his attentions. As usual, she raised Vincenzo's agenda. I want to offer you a good word on behalf of our poor brother, although I may be speaking out of turn, yet I beseech you to forgive him his mistake this time, blaming his youth as the real cause for his committing such a blunder, which, being his first, merits pardon. I therefore entreat you once again to take him with you to Rome, and there, where you will not lack for opportunities, you can give your son the guidance that your paternal duty and all your natural goodness and loving tenderness seek to provide him. Vincenzo, now 17, had turned out to be the sullen, thankless opposite of his industrious older sister. Attending college in Pisa, he squandered money and taxed the goodwill of Galileo's dear friend Benedetto Castelli, to whose care he had been entrusted. None of Castelli's letters clarify, however, what particular infraction of Vincenzo's provoked the paternal anger on this occasion. "For the future," Galileo wrote in exasperation to Castelli of Vincenzo's frequent financial demands during his student days, "he is to be content with 3 scudi a month for pocket money.
With this he can buy plaster figures, pens, paper, or anything else he likes, and he may consider himself lucky to have as many scudi as I, at his age, had groats.
Toward the end of November, after the Assayer appeared in print and won acclaim in Rome, Suor Maria Celeste requested a copy, among other favors from her father, on what she suspected to be the eve of his departure. Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, between the infinite love I bear you, sire, and my fear that this sudden cold, which ordinarily troubles you so much, may aggravate your current aches and indispositions, I find it impossible to remain without news of you. Therefore I beg to hear how you are, sire, and also when you think you will be setting off on your journey. I have hastened my work on the linens, and they are almost finished. But in applying the fringe, of which I am sending you a sample, I see I will not have enough for the last two cloths, as I need almost another four braccia. Please do everything you can to get this to me quickly, so I can send them all to you before you leave, as it is for the purpose of your upcoming trip that I have taken such pains to finish them. Since I do not have a room where I can sleep through the night, Suor Diamanta, by her kindness, lets me stay in hers, depriving her own sister of that hospitality in order to take me in. But the room is terribly cold now, and with my head so infected, I cannot see how I will be able to stand it there, sire, unless you help me by lending me one of your bed hangings, one of the white ones, that you will not need to use now while you are away. I am most eager to know if you can do me this service, and another thing I ask of you, please, is to send me your book, the one that has just been published, so that I may read it, as I am longing to see what it says. Here are some cakes I made a few days ago, hoping to give them to you when you came to bid us adieu. I see that this will not happen quite as soon as I feared, and so I want you to have them before they turn hard. Suor Arcangela continues still to purge herself, and she does not feel terribly well after having had the two cauteries on her thighs. I am still not very well either, but by now I am so accustomed to poor health that I hardly think about it, seeing how it pleases the Lord to keep testing me always with some little pain or other. I thank him, and I pray that he grant you, sire, the greatest possible well-being in all respects. And to close, I send you loving greetings from me and from Suor Arcangela. From San Mateo, the 21st day of November, 1623. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. If you have collars to be bleached, sire, you may send them to us.
Chapter 11. What We Require Above All Else. In the great silence that descended over the convent after the evening prayers, the 30 sisters of San Mateo lay asleep in their beds, fully clothed. Should death come to call for one of them in the night, she would be dressed and ready to enter the next life. Or, when the bell summoning the nuns to matins disturbed the darkness at midnight, they all could rise from their straw mattresses and go at once, without delay, padding in barefoot procession to the choir to meet their bridegroom Jesus by candlelight. Venite adoremus, they chanted as they took their places near the altar under the church grill for the office of the Annunciation, the first round of devotions in a new day. The nuns touched their foreheads to the stone floor, made the sign of the cross on their lips, then rose and kneeled in worship, supplicating for all those who might be aided by their prayers. In the pre-dawn shadows following the choral recitation of matins and lauds, the sisters returned briefly to their cells for the remainder of their sleep. But it was probably during this period before sunrise on December 10th, 1623, that Suor Maria Celeste found the time to complete a secret letter to her father regarding a matter of supreme importance to the convent. Galileo, still intending to go to Rome, had offered to petition the Pope on behalf of the nuns of San Mateo. He wanted Suor Maria Celeste, given her inside knowledge of their plight, to inform him of their greatest need. Over the past few days, she had sought the advice of the Mother Abbess and other trusted sisters, finally relying on her own observations to reach a decision as to what would serve the community best. She had rejected the notion of a gift of alms. Of course, the convent was indigent, and as a result, the nuns often went hungry. But poor Clares consciously chose to live in continual abstinence.
Their founding mother, Claire, herself had cherished the privilege of poverty as the clearest imitation of Christ. After her protector, Francis of Assisi, died in 1226, Claire battled successfully to maintain her right to own nothing, despite the objections of church officials who feared she would starve to death. Bending to her will, Pope Gregory IX permitted the poor ladies at San Damiano to continue their tradition of corporate and individual poverty. "The sisters shall not appropriate anything to themselves, neither a house nor a place nor anything whatsoever, and as strangers and pilgrims in this world, serving the Lord in poverty and humility, let them confidently send for alms." The Rule of St. Clare, Chapter 8. Pope Gregory, however, weighing the general welfare of the Clarisses throughout Italy and France, had forced other convents to accept real property that could be sold or rented for profit. By the 17th century, this practice enjoyed wide vogue. Surely the new Pope Urban, if approached by an individual he admired as much as he did Galileo, might easily cede to San Matteo a prosperous estate that generated enough income to buy food and blankets aplenty. Something far worse than material poverty, in Suor Maria Celeste's analysis, threatened to undermine San Matteo. Therefore she made bold to name the problem to her father and to suggest precisely how the Pope might crush the menace. Her letter described the impropriety of the men attending certain supervisory needs of the convent, beginning with the spiritual guidance that had once come from the Blessed Francis himself. "Our visitator shall always be from the order of friars minor according to the will and instruction of our cardinal, and let him be such as to be well known for his integrity and manner of living. His duty will be to correct faults committed against the form of our profession, whether in the head or in the members." The Rule of St. Clare, Chapter 12. If the visitator was wanting, the chaplains were worse. Yet, since the church did not allow women to administer the sacraments, the convent required a chaplain or two for special purposes, such as hearing confession, anointing the sick, and celebrating the Mass. The current chaplain attending San Matteo exemplified the crowd of uneducated, unethical clerics who infiltrated ecclesiastical ranks at almost every level in 17th century Italy, making a mockery of religious life wherever they came to roost. Although the Council of Trent, at its conclusion in 1563, had tried to rout these unscrupulous characters by calling for the establishment of seminaries, one in every diocese, to train truly devout young men for holy office, such schools had not yet proliferated widely enough, and many incompetent priests continued to obtain positions through apprenticeships or political connections.
Suor Maria Celeste surmised that replacing the current priest, who had no experience of monastic life, with a friar would transform morale at the convent.
The Council of Trent had also reduced the tenure of Mother Abbesses from a lifetime appointment to an elected post that passed to a new occupant by a vote held every 3 years. At San Matteo later this very day, in fact, just such a ballot would decide the successor to Suor Laura Gaetani, or Madonna, as the nuns called her, who was now conducting the morning office for the very last time. Another pealing of the sacristan's bell sounded the beginning of prime. Fully awake, washed, and reassembled in the choir, the sisters pressed on with their intercessions for the sinful and the anguished. They had not spoken any words of ordinary conversation since the previous evening, following the rule's admonition to keep silence until the hour of terce. Now they sang hymns to Suor Maria Grazia's accompaniment at the old, dilapidated organ, breakfasted on bread, and bent to their work. Sometime during the 3 hours of chores after terce, before the midday chanting of St. Clare's own favorite canonical hours of sext and none, Suor Maria Celeste could have found time to fold her two densely filled sheets of paper lengthwise in quarters, then in half to make a small square, seal the edges, and pass the packet to the steward for delivery to Bello Sguardo. "Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, I was hoping to be able to respond in person, sire, to everything you said in your most solicitous letter of several days ago. I see, however, that time may prohibit us from meeting before you take your leave, and so I am resolved to share my thoughts with you in writing. Above all, I want you to know how happy you made me by offering so lovingly to help our convent. I conferred with Madonna and other elders here, all of whom expressed their gratitude for the nature of your offer. But because they were uncertain, not knowing how to come to a decision among themselves, Madonna wrote to our governor, and he answered that since the convent is so impoverished, alms were probably needed more than anything. Meanwhile, I had several discussions with one particular nun who seems to me to surpass all the others here in wisdom and goodwill. And she, moved not by passion or self-interest, but by sincere zeal, advised me, indeed beseeched me, to ask you for something which would undoubtedly be of great use to us, and yet very easy for you, sire, to obtain. That is, to implore His Holiness to let us have for our confessor a regular or brother in whom we can confide, with the possibility that he may be replaced every 3 years, as is the custom at convents, by someone equally dependable. A confessor who will not interfere with the normal observances of our order, but simply let us receive from him the holy sacraments. It is this that we require above all else, and so much so that I can hardly express its crucial importance, or the background circumstances that make it so, although I have tried to list several of them in the enclosed paper that I am sending along with this letter. But because I know, sire, that you cannot, on the basis of a simple word from me, make such a demand, without hearing from others more experienced in such matters, you can look for a way when you come here to broach the question with Madonna, to try to get a sense of her feelings on the matter, and also to discuss it with any of the more elderly mothers, without, of course, exposing your reasons for mentioning such things. And please, breathe not a word of this to Master Benedetto, her uncle, the father of Suor Chiara, since he would undoubtedly divulge it to Suor Chiara, who would then spread it among the other nuns and thus ruin us, because it is impossible for so many brains to be of one mind. And as a consequence, the actions of a single person who might be particularly displeased by this idea could thwart our efforts. Surely, it would be wrong to let two or three individuals deprive everyone in the group of all the benefits, both spiritual and practical, that could accrue from the success of this plan. Now it is up to you, sire, with your sound judgment, to which we appeal, to determine whether you deem it appropriate to pose our entreaty, and how best to present it so as to achieve the desired end most easily, since, as far as I am concerned, our petition seems entirely legitimate, and all the more so for our being in such dire straits. I made it a point to write to you today, sire, as this is rather a quiet time, and I think the right time for you to come to us, before things get stirred up again, so that you can see for yourself what may need to be done in respecting the stature of the older nuns, as I have already explained. Because I fear imposing on you too heavily, I will leave off writing here, saving all the other things to tell you later in person. Today we expect a visit from Monsignor Vicar, who is coming to attend the election of the new abbess. May it please God to see the one who bends most to his will elected to this post, and may he grant you, sire, an abundance of his holy grace. From San Mateo, the 10th day of December, 1623, most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste.
The enclosed paper reads as follows.
The first and foremost motive which drives us to make this plea is the clear recognition and awareness of how these priests' paltry knowledge or understanding of the orders and obligations that are part of our religious life allow us, or, to say it better, tempt us to live ever more loosely with scant observance of our rule. And how can one doubt that once we begin to live without fear of God, we will be subject to continual misery with regard to the temporal matters of this world? Therefore we must address the primary cause, which is this one that I have just told you. A second problem is that since our convent finds itself in poverty, as you know, sire, it cannot satisfy the confessors who leave every 3 years by giving them their salary before they go. I happen to know that three of those who were here are owed quite a large sum of money, and they use this debt as occasion to come here often to dine with us and to fraternize with several of the nuns. And what is worse, they then carry us in their mouths, spreading rumors and gossiping about us wherever they go, to the point where our convent is considered the concubine of the whole Casentino region. Whence come these confessors of ours, more suited to hunting rabbits than guiding souls? And believe me, sire, if I wanted to tell you all the blunders committed by the one we have with us now, I would never come to the bottom of the list, because they are as numerous as they are incredible. The third thing will be that a regular must never be so ignorant that he does not know much more than one of these types, or if he does not know, at least he will not flee the convent, as has been the constant practice of our priests here, on the occasion of any little happenstance, to seek advice from the bishopric or elsewhere, as though that were any way to comport oneself or counsel others. But rather he will consult some learned father of his own order. And in this fashion our affairs will be known in only one convent and not all over Florence as they are now. More than this, if he has gained nothing else from his own experience, he will well understand the boundaries that a brother must respect between himself and the nuns in order for them to live as quietly as possible. Whereas a priest who comes here without having, so to speak, knowledge of nuns, may complete the whole designated 3 years of his required stay without ever learning our obligations and rule. We are not really requesting fathers of one religious order in preference over another, trusting ourselves to the judgment of he who will obtain and grant us such a favor. It is very true that the Reformed Carmelites of Santa Maria Maggiore, who have come here many times as special confessors, have served us most satisfactorily in the offices we are prohibited from performing ourselves. And I believe that they would better conform to our need. First, being themselves very devout fathers and highly esteemed, and moreover, because they do not covet fancy gifts, nor concern themselves, being well accustomed to poverty, with a grandiose lifestyle, as members of some other orders have sought here. Certain priests, sent to us as confessors, spent the whole 3 years serving only their own interests, and the more they could wring out of us, the more skillful they considered themselves. But without straining to make further allegations, sire, I urge you to judge for yourself the conditions at other convents, such as San Jacopo and Santa Monica, now that they have come under the influence of brothers who took steps to set them on the proper path. We are by no means asking to shirk the obedience of our order, but only to be administered the sacraments and governed by persons of experience who appreciate the true significance of their calling. Legend held that Mother Claire often chanted Sext and Non, which commemorate the crucifixion and death of Jesus, in tears. Her daughters at San Mateo followed these offices with prayers of gratitude for the convent's benefactors, and then filed two by two, still singing, to the refectory. There the nun whose turn it was to read aloud at dinner regaled her sisters with stories from the lives of the saints, though not for long, as it took only a few minutes to finish the scant fare, usually broth and a vegetable, before returning to their prayers. At vespers in the early afternoon the nuns knelt in the choir stalls, listening to the bells ring evensong. Another bell, the capitolo, rang soon afterward, during what would normally have been another period of silent work, calling them to chapter for the election that saw Suor Hortensia del Nente, the convent's expert lacemaker, inaugurated as their new mother abbess. The one elected should reflect upon what kind of burden she has taken up, and to whom an account of the flock entrusted to her is to be rendered. She should also strive to lead the way for the others more by virtue and a holy way of acting than by her office, so that, roused by her example, the sisters might obey her more out of love than out of fear. The Rule of St. Clare, Chapter 4. The founding Clare, in contrast, had headed San Damiano all her days. These passed mostly in quiet reverence, memorably broken by an invasion of mercenary soldiers in September of 1240, during which skirmish Clare, who had been bedridden by illness for 6 years, stood up with the assistance of 2 nuns and drove out the enemy by the power of her prayers. Clare's canonization in 1255 resulted partly from this act of valor, as well as one supporting nun's eyewitness testimony under oath that God had spoken to Clare. "I will guard you always and defend you," he said, while the Saracens scaled the walls of San Damiano, and partly on the basis of miracles following her death as signs of her sanctity. Pilgrims brought to Clare's tomb were variously cured there of epilepsy, paralysis, withered limbs, hunchback, dementia, madness, and blindness. "I bless you during my life and after my death, as much as I am able and even more than I am able, with all the blessings by which the Father of Mercies has blessed and will bless his spiritual sons and daughters in heaven and on earth. Amen." Blessing of St. Clare. The days at San Mateo drew to a close during evening meditation after the hymn and the rosary in solitude. Then all the nuns fell to their knees and fully prostrate on the floor to beg each other's forgiveness for any pain one sister might inadvertently have caused another through all the preceding hours. At Compline, they convened chorally once more in the gathering darkness, as each nun prepared to meet her holy bridegroom or her death, whichever the great silence held in store for her this night. Chapter 12. Because of Our Zeal. In the spring of 1624, after the cold rain stopped falling and the roads again became passable, Galileo set out at last for the Vatican. On April 1st, he left Florence in a horse-drawn litter lent him for the occasion by the 13-year-old Grand Duke of Tuscany, Ferdinando II. Although Galileo still enjoyed the privileges of his ties to the Pitti Palace and continued to draw his stipend from the University of Pisa as the Medici family's chief mathematician and philosopher, none of these conditions prohibited his courting the greater favor of the new pope. It could even be argued that Galileo required the pope's aegis in order to guarantee the loyalty of Ferdinando's pious female regents, Madama Cristina and Archduchess Maria Maddalena. En route to Rome, Galileo stopped for 2 weeks in Acquasparta as the guest of his friend and patron, Prince Cesi, whom he hadn't seen in 8 years. Cesi preferred to spend as much time as possible at his country estate, where he happily devoted himself to botany, writing, and the compilation of his Encyclopedia of Natural History, the crowning, though ever unfinished, work of the Lynxian Academy. Prince Cesi naturally anticipated publishing Galileo's own new book project, the one about the system and composition of the universe, the one the court philosopher had dreamed on and off of writing since his first telescopic observations in Padua some 15 years before. The edict of 1616 had all but killed the idea until now, when the vibrance of Rome's new order promised unprecedented intellectual freedom. First, of course, Galileo had to broach the proposal with Pope Urban and gauge his response to its content. Prince Cesi had specifically invited Galileo to his home outside Rome to prepare him for that audience, so Galileo could reach the Vatican not in the dark, but well informed as to what might be necessary in returning to the subject of Copernicus. Even as Prince Cesi and Galileo discussed these prospects, news from Rome on April 11th dampened their spirits. Virginio Cesarini, the prince's cousin and their fellow Lynxian academician, immortalized as the addressee of the assayer, had died at 27 of tuberculosis. "Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, what great happiness was delivered here, sire, along with the news, via the letter that you ordered sent to Master Benedetto Landucci, of the safe progress of your journey as far as Acquasparta, and for all of this we offer thanks to God, Master of all. We are also delighted to learn of the favors you received from Prince Cesi, and we hope to have even greater occasion for rejoicing when we hear tell of your arrival in Rome, sire, where persons of grand stature most eagerly await you, even though I know that your joy must be tainted with considerable sorrow, on account of the sudden death of Signor Don Virginio Cesarini, so esteemed and so loved by you. I too have been saddened by his passing, thinking only of the grief that you must endure, sire, for the loss of such a dear friend, just when you stood on the verge of soon seeing him again. Surely this event gives us occasion to reflect on the falsity and vanity of all hopes tied to this wretched world. But because I would not have you think, sire, that I want to sermonize by letter, I will say no more except to let you know how we fare, for I can tell you that everyone here is very well indeed, and all the nuns send you their loving regards. As for myself, I pray that our Lord grant you the fulfillment of your every just desire. From San Mateo, the 26th day of April, 1624. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. This is the only letter of Suor Maria Celeste's that Galileo salvaged from the tumult of 1624. More than a year separates it from the next in his collection, so that her response to his intercession with the Pope on San Mateo's behalf is lost in the lacuna. That Galileo petitioned effectively, however, is borne out by later letters that mention our Father Confessor in complete comfort as someone who sends regards to Galileo, even watches Galileo's house for him when he is out of town, and once asks for help settling some personal business in Rome. Galileo rode into Rome on April 23rd. The following day, Pope Urban received him congenially in a private audience for the first time, and then five more times in as many weeks over the course of Galileo's stay. The old friends strolled through the Vatican gardens for an hour at a time, treating all the topics Galileo had hoped to discuss with His Holiness. Although no one recorded the content of Galileo's springtime sessions with Urban in 1624, there can be little doubt they assessed the fallout from the momentous decree that had dominated their last days together. Many Italian scientists felt their hands tied by the edict of 1616. Outside Italy, however, few heeded the anti-Copernican ruling. As Galileo probably knew from his correspondence across Europe, no astronomer in France, Spain, Germany, or England had even bothered to make the required corrections to De Revolutionibus, published in 1620. In a sense, the edict had made Italy lose face among scientists abroad. There were rumors, too, to make Urban wince, of Germans on the verge of converting to Catholicism who backed away because of the edict. Urban, now more than halfway through the first year of his pontificate, was proud to say he had never supported that decree, and that it would not have seen the light had he been pope in those days. As a cardinal, he had successfully intervened, along with his colleague Bonifacio Cardinal Caetani, to keep heresy out of the edict's final wording. Thus, although the consultors to the Holy Office had called the immobility of the son formally heretical, in their February 1616 report, the March 5th edict merely stated that the doctrine was false and contrary to Holy Scripture. Why had Maffeo Barberini, a man with no vested interest in the sun-centered universe, taken such action? His admiration for Galileo could well have figured in his thinking, but he no doubt had other reasons too. Both Cardinal Barberini and Cardinal Caetani, having studied some astronomy, distinguished themselves from theologians who never looked up to heaven except to pray. Neither cardinal believed in the physical reality of the heliocentric universe, of course, but they recognized its merit as a way of thinking about cosmology. They also valued De Revolutionibus itself as a mathematical tour de force, and they wanted to preserve the intellectual freedom of Catholic scholars to read it, pending certain revisions. Cardinal Caetani argued so strongly in favor of the book, in fact, that he was later chosen as the one to amend it. The 8 years since the edict had not swayed Urban from his position on Copernicus. He still saw no harm in using the Copernican system as a tool for astronomical calculations and predictions. The sun-centered universe remained merely an unproven idea without, Urban felt certain, any prospect of proof in the future.
Therefore, if Galileo wished to apply his science and his eloquence to a consideration of Copernican doctrine, he could proceed with the Pope's blessing, so long as he labeled the system a hypothesis. By the time Galileo started back to Florence on June 8th, he had secured not only the promise of a pension for Vincenzo and redress for San Matteo, but a personal letter from Urban to young Ferdinando in which the Pope lauded the Grand Duke's premier philosopher. "We embrace with paternal love this great man whose fame shines in the heavens and goes on earth far and wide." All these favorable words and gestures heartened Galileo, convinced him that he could indeed resume his public musings about an earth in motion about the sun. Before attempting the book-length tome, however, Galileo decided to write something along its lines as a trial run by replying to an anti-Copernican treatise that had circulated through Rome since 1616. Though unpublished, the still uncontested comments of Monsignor Francesco Ingoli, secretary of the Congregation of the Propagation of the Faith, seemed to beg for a response, especially as these comments had originated in a debate with Galileo. In 1616, during Galileo's aggressive Copernican campaign in Rome, he had staged one of his evening disputes against the very same Ingoli. Afterward, the two of them agreed to write down their respective positions. No sooner had Ingoli done his half, however, than the edict of 1616 intruded, leaving the written phase of the contest incomplete. Even now, Galileo hesitated to take on a man like Ingoli, who had based many of his points on theology instead of astronomy. However, he began drafting the ticklish response immediately upon his return to Bello Sguardo.
8 years have already passed, Signor Ingoli, Galileo began, since while in Rome I received from you an essay written almost in the form of a letter addressed to me. In it you try to demonstrate the falsity of the Copernican hypothesis, concerning which there was much turmoil at that time.
Having refreshed Ingoli's memory of the events, Galileo excused his own silence as the only appropriate response to the weakness of Ingoli's arguments. Galileo could have swatted these away in a single blow, except, of course, the theological ones, but he simply hadn't bothered to refute Ingoli because he deemed the effort a waste of time and breath.
However, Galileo continued, I have now discovered very tangibly that I was completely wrong in this belief of mine. Having recently gone to Rome to pay my respects to His Holiness Pope Urban VIII, to whom I am tied by an old acquaintance and by many favors I have received, I found it is firmly and generally believed that I have been silent because I was convinced by your demonstrations. Thus I have found myself being forced to answer your essay, though, as you see, very late and against my will.
Galileo applied all his talents of tact in this letter, not so much to suffer Ingoli, whom he variously insulted for bringing forth absurdities, for basing discussions on idle imagination and for uttering great inanities, but rather to handle the theological overtones of the Copernican controversy with all necessary caution.
Note, Signor Ingoli, that I do not undertake this task with the thought or aim of supporting as true a proposition which has already been declared suspect and repugnant to a doctrine higher than physical and astronomical disciplines in dignity and authority.
Instead, Galileo made it clear that he replied to rectify his own reputation, and to show Protestants to the north, who had no doubt read Ingoli's manuscript, notably Kepler, that Catholics in general understood much more about astronomy than Ingoli's essay might lead them to believe.
"I am thinking about treating this topic very extensively," confessed Galileo, "in opposition to heretics, the most influential of whom, I hear, accept Copernicus's opinion. I would want to show them that we Catholics continue to be certain of the old truth taught us by the sacred authors, not for lack of scientific understanding or for not having studied as many arguments, experiments, observations, and demonstrations as they have, but rather because of the reverence we have toward the writings of our fathers and because of our zeal in religion and faith.
Italian astronomers, in other words, could tolerate the cognitive dissonance of admiring Copernicus on a theoretical level while rejecting him theologically.
Thus, when the Protestants see that we understand very well all their astronomical and physical reasons, and indeed also others much more powerful than those advanced till now, at most they will blame us as men who are steadfast in our beliefs, but not as blind to and ignorant of the human disciplines.